And so, instead of marshalling the skills he has honed in debating club, appealing to Ruprecht's love of the arts, reminding him of the duty people like Jeekers and Ruprecht have to uphold and preserve these finer things from the troglodytes surrounding them. Instead of this, after some procrastinatory throat-clearing, he just says,
"All of us are parents coming to the concert, and they're going to be pretty cross if we're not playing. I know you're an orphan, but try to think how it feels for us, having our parents getting cross with us, just because you don't want to play."
With that, he steps back and shrugs happily at Jeff, leaving Ruprecht's catatonia unstirred. Jeff, in desperation, fixes an eye on Dennis.
"What?
Can't you say something to him?"
"Why should I say anything to him? I don't even want to be in this lame concert. As far as I'm concerned, he's doing me a favor."
"It's not just about the concert, though, it's..."
Jeff falters, sincerity being to Dennis what salt is to slugs.
"Like, maybe if you said sorry to him, that might help."
"Sorry?"
Dennis is incredulous.
"For what?"
"For the whole Optimus Prime thing. And all the stuff you said."
"I was trying to help him. I was trying to help him stop being such an asshole."
Jeff's mouth sets in a tight line.
"Well, why did you come up here, then?"
Dennis shrugs. He isn't sure why he came up here. To see Ruprecht in squalor, with the shell of his genius stripped away, and the grotesque, soft-squirming larva of his true self revealed to all? To have everything Dennis said over the years gloriously confirmed, viz., that everything good is fatally flawed, that life is inherently evil, that for those reasons there is no point trying or caring or hoping. Something along those lines, anyway. Jeff keeps staring at him. Dennis shrugs again and leaves the dorm. In the rec room, he sits down by himself, smirking to show how unguilty he is feeling. For a little while, he watches the table tennis, then turns to the window. As he looks out, something enters the car park below. It is a van, a dark brown van, and on it is written in gold lettering, "Van Doren Drainage. Septic tanks emptied. Toilets unblocked. Leaks fixed. For all your plumbing needs, no job too small." The van pulls up alongside the flower beds, and a small, unprepossessing man in an ill-fitting suit and a voluminous woman with a floral hat, both of them somehow familiar, emerge from either side. Dennis watches as they bustle over to the school doors. A slow, wolfish smile spreads over his chops.
"Well, well,"
he says to himself.
"Look who's back from the Amazon."
Making the right impression, as Father Foley never tires of telling the boys, is half the battle in any situation. You might have straight A's in your leaving cert, but walk into the prospective employer's office with scuffed shoes or an inappropriate tie, and you've as good as flushed your chances down the toilet. That is why, even though he had previously washed it only last night, Father Foley, understanding the gravity and delicacy of this particular case, took the trouble of washing his hair again this morning, and spent the quarter hour prior to the interview arranging it until he judged it exactly right. Contrast this effort with the young man on the other side of the desk. Here we have a lad who clearly does not care a jot about impressions. His posture is slovenly. He is grossly overweight. And, to top it off, he will not speak. Not one word. Father Foley struggled for several minutes to get through to him. Now he addresses his comments solely to the parents, leaving the boy out of it. See how he likes it.
"There are 5 stages of bereavement,"
he tells them.
"Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance."
He has just been reading about this on the internet. It's actually very interesting.
"Obviously, young Ruprecht here is presently going through the anger stage. Now that is perfectly natural. Indeed, it is a vital part of the grieving process. Nevertheless, we are getting to a point at which Ruprecht's grief is having a negative effect on the orderly running of the school. So, what the acting principal and I are hoping is that if we all put our heads together, we might be able to find some way of getting Ruprecht to the acceptance stage sooner rather than later, so to speak, or at least to one of the other less disruptive stages that would enable him to participate constructively in normal school activities, such as the 140th anniversary concert.
The boy's father, a man of few words, nods somberly. The woman in the hat claps her hands very quietly and mouths,
"A concert!"
Father Foley is pleased to give her some details about the event. Some of the priests tend to look down on the whole thing, but from his studies in psychology, Father Foley knows the importance of letting the lads express themselves. Indeed, in his younger days, wasn't a certain Father Ignatius Foley known to strap on the guitar and strum out a few hits for the entertainment of long-term and terminally sick children in hospital? The way those youngsters had looked at him, he was quite the pop star.
"And the touching thing,"
he continues,
"is that a portion of the proceeds have been dedicated to refurbishing the swimming pool in memory of the unfortunate boy, Daniel Juster."
The boy's mother, who some might call quite an attractive person, coos at this approvingly. Father Foley returns an avuncular smile.
"It seemed to us to be the most appropriate way of marking the event,"
he says.
"Here at Seabrook we don't believe in brushing things under the carpet. It is a way for us, for the boys, and the faculty alike, to say, Daniel, you will always have a place in our hearts, in spite of, that is to say, the circumstances of your passing."
Sweeping a loose strand of golden hair back over his brow, he turns to Ruprecht, who is staring back at him with undisguised hatred. Can he really be her son? Perhaps she is a second wife. She does seem considerably younger. But no, only a mother could dote on a repellent being like this.
"There are two words I should like you to keep in mind during this difficult time, Ruprecht. The first of them is love. You are lucky to be loved by many people, by your father and your..."
He can't resist it.
"Very charming mother."
A twinkling, effervescent little smile.
"By your acting principal, by myself and the rest of the faculty, and by your many friends here in Seabrook College. And most of all, by God. God loves you, Ruprecht. God loves all of his creation, down to the very lowliest. And he never takes his eyes from you, even when you think you are alone in the world. Daniel is hopefully with him in heaven now, and he is happy there, happy in God's love. So let us not be selfish, let us not let our grief interfere with the good, honest work of our peers. Yes, we have suffered a tremendous loss, but let us mourn Daniel's passing in the correct way, the loving way, such as by participating in the upcoming Christmas concert and making it a really special occasion he would be proud of."
The boy's mother is rapt. So indeed is the father. Father Foley is rather pleased with this little homily himself.
"The second word, or actually two words, is, or are, team sports. In the days of the Roman Empire..."
Afterwards, he waits outside the automator's office, while his parents have a private interview inside. Darren Boyce and Jason Rycroft come along and stand across the hallway, just staring at him. When his parents come out, he walks them down to the van. They would like to stay longer, but Father is terribly busy. In the car park, Mother cups Ruprecht's face in her hands.
"Dearest Ruprecht, we love you very much. Promise me you will remember that one thing, that whatever happens, Mama and Papa will always love you.
Let's have no more of this silliness, Ruprecht, Father says. He wipes his mouth with a paper tissue. Ruprecht returns to his room alone. On his pillow has been laid, neatly, a toilet brush. He removes it and lies down. Mother loves Ruprecht. Laurie loves Skippy. God loves everybody. To hear people talk, you would think no one ever did anything but love each other. But when you look for it, when you search out this love everyone is talking about, it is nowhere to be found. And when someone looks for love from you, you find you are not able to give it. You are not able to hold the trust and dreams they want you to hold, any more than you could cradle water in your arms. Proposition. Love, if it exists at all, does so primarily as an organizing myth of a similar nature to God. Or, love is analogous to gravity, as postulated in recent theories. That is to say, what we experience faintly, sporadically, as love, is in actuality the distant emanation of another world, the faraway glow of a love universe that by the time it gets to us has almost no warmth left. When he gets up, he spends an hour kicking and stamping on his French horn, so he will not have to play it again. Music, maths, these are things that no longer make any sense to him. They are too perfect. They do not belong here. He does not know how he ever believed this universe could be a symphony, played on superstrings, when it sounds like shit, played on shit. With the revelation of his true origins, the last vestiges of Ruprecht's dignity are torn away. Wherever he goes now, a wave of plumbing-related ridicule pursues him. His head is forced so often down the U-bends of Seabrook commodes. It's a gateway to another dimension, Ruprecht. Flush, that it never fully dries. The worse it gets, the worse it gets. Because in school your enemy is anyone you can't fight off. So the more enemies you have, the more you'll find queuing up to join the fun. Ruprecht lumbers through it like some elephantine golem. He does not cry out when someone flicks his ear with a rubber band, or slices his arse with a ruler, or jabs it with a compass point, or mushes wet tissue in his ears, or spits on his back, or leaves a dump in his shoe. He does not complain when Noddy boards up the door of his laboratory. He does not protest when he is given detention after several of his non-water-resistant possessions are found blocking one of the dorm toilets. He does not show any signs of caring when his room is festooned yet again with toilet roll. Instead, he merely withdraws further into himself, into the ever-expanding cellulite fortress he buttresses daily with donuts and a new Ed's milkshake called Sweet Dreams, which contains no milk and more calories, somehow, than pure sugar.
I'm just concerned that the school's attitude might come across as somewhat confrontational.
Van Doren's the one who's being confrontational, Howard. Firm, but fair. That's what we're being. Am I right, brother?
A svelt ebony nod from the sentinel in the corner.
But the boys... There does seem to be some evidence that the boys may be ganging up on him.
The boys know the rules, Howard, and if they're caught breaking the rules, they'll be punished for it. At the same time, they've all put a lot of time and effort into this concert, and if one person is spoiling it for everyone on a whim, then I can understand why they'd be angry. And I can understand that they need to express that anger.
Yes, but...
No one's bigger than this school, Howard.
The automator's attaché case snaps closed like the jaws of a crocodile.
Van Doren's going to find that out, sooner or later. I just hope for his sake that it's sooner.
And so Howard merely looks on, as by the day the glutinous orb of Van Doren's face grows wider, paler, converging on a dinner plate blankness. His yearning to take him aside, to comfort him, simply to speak to him, cancelled out by an equally agonizing guilt. For what could Howard possibly say to him that wouldn't be a bare-faced lie? And if he told him the truth, how would that help him?